Part 4 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Book 2, Chapters 1 through 6.
So we come now to Liber Secundus, the second book. He has a short introductory passage at the beginning of Book 2, which is entitled in German, The Images of the Erring, The Bilder des Irrenden, may be better translated as The Images of the One Prone to Error, the Erring One. The text, however, on the first page is in Latin, so it's a little bit like the Seven Sermons to the Dead. There is Latin and there is German. And the text on the first page consists of two passages from the prophet Jeremiah's chapter 23, which, however, are not identified as to the source. You know, usually when you have a biblical quotation, you put where it comes from. But that's what they are. And both passages emphasize that prophets are subject to error, because they may speak personally from their own mind and not from, as he puts it, the mouth of the Lord, which is, of course, a biblical expression. Jeremiah says that in the words of prophet times in Alexandria, you know, there are very few peoples on the face of this earth who are so verbal as the Greeks. You know, I had a Greek friend once here, whenever he came to see me, and he usually had some purpose. It took anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and 15 minutes before he came to the point. Before that, we were drinking coffee, of course, what else does one do? Greek coffee. But, you know, all sorts of conversation, because it's impolite to come to the point right away. So there's a great deal of verbalizing, great deal of loquaciousness. And so this fellow definitely was in that camp, and he was very successful by doing that as a lecturer and a teacher. Then eventually he became a Christian. In fact, down the line, he tells the story how that happened. But even regarding the Christian scriptures, he was at first, as he said, a slave to words. But he has abandoned that slavery to words. Obviously something, a meaning that is not verbal, or at least can't be easily expressed in words, is what he was after. And then here the anchorite and Jung carry on a discussion about the word and concept of logos, as it has been used by Philo of Alexandria, and of course also in the Gospel of John. But soon it becomes likely that there is a much of ancient Egyptian lore present in the environment, and even in the thinking of the anchorite, who then finally retires and leaves Jung to his rest. But maybe another word about Philo and the Logos doctrine and so forth needs to be said. Jung had stated, for instance, that he took the name and presumably at least some of the concept of archetype, not from Plato, but from Philo of Alexandria. Philo, who often is called Philo the Jew, Philo Judeus, was obviously a Jewish philosopher who interpreted, let's say, the Jewish religion in a highly mystical and highly philosophical and Platonic manner. And he had spoke about the Logos and Sophia, Logos and Chokmah as the pair. So this was very much in the nature of a stimulus to Gnostic thinking. And of course the Gospel of John, particularly that famous first chapter, the poem of the Gospel of John, has been a favorite of mystical and Gnostic and Gnosticizing people throughout the ages. It was the gospel that the Cathars read, for instance, and it's, you know, really of a highly esoteric nature. He notes very soon when he comes to the anchorite's place, Jung notes that an Egyptian tomb was nearby, And then the anchorite brings him something to eat, which is probably quite welcome. And what he brings him are dates and water and bread. And Dr. Shamdasani notes that those three things were the most commonly presented offerings to the dead by the Egyptians. They would bring, even, no one was so poor that they couldn't afford a little bread, a few dates and some water, and they would bring that to the dead, into the tombs. So already sort of the ancient Egyptian element begins to kind of bleed through, and this is quite significant. Jung begins a long meditation on the advantages of solitary life, and he states that the presence of the solitary, of the anchorite in the desert, and also the proximity to the sun, is of great importance in that regard. So he feels that the setting in the desert is an important part that leads to the experiences, the insights of the anchorite. Yeah. So here is part of this long meditation. I probably won't read all of it, but it's very beautiful. The life of the solitary would be cold were it not for the immense sun, which makes the air and rocks glow. The sun and its eternal splendor replace for the solitary his own life warmth. His heart longs for the sun. He wanders to the lands of the sun. He dreams of the flickering splendor of the sun, of the hot red stone spread out at midday, of the golden hot rays of dry sand. See, now he begins to see something in the desert that is not just barrenness and lack of life, as he had mentioned before. The solitary seeks the sun, and no one else is so ready to open his heart as he is. Therefore, he loves the desert above all, since he loves its deep stillness. He needs little food, since the sun and its glow nourish him. Consequently, the solitary loves the desert above all, since it is a mother to him, giving him food and invigorating warmth at regular hours. In the desert, the solitary is relieved of care, and therefore turns his whole life to the sprouting garden of his soul, which can flourish only under a hot sun. In his garden, the delicious red fruit grows that bears swelling sweetness under a tight skin. These are, of course, all metaphors. You think that the solitary is poor. You do not see that he strolls under laden fruit trees and that his hand touches grain a hundredfold. On the dark leaves, the overfull reddish blossoms swell toward him from abundant buds, and the fruit almost bursts with thronging juices. Fragrant resins drip from his trees, and under his feet, thrusting seed breaks open. Of course, this is visionary. If the sun sinks onto the plain of the sea like an exhausted bird, the solitary envelops himself and holds his breath. He does not move, and is pure expectancy until the miracle of the renewed light rises in the east. Brimful, delicious expectation is in the solitary. And actually the meditation goes on from there. But you can see here also that just in basic terms that there is a similarity, certainly with ancient Egyptian thinking. And that is what he leads us toward. So he concludes the chapter by exhorting us that we should not worship words. Man is the creator of the word. Let the word return to man. Let man bring light to darkness and find the light in the darkness. So he, one of the big insights that comes to him by way of his contact with the anchorite Ammonius is that one has to look beyond words, that the attempt to define and describe everything in words has grave limitations, that words are not all there is. And that is certainly an important insight, and it's the kind of insight that especially academics, I think, gravely need. And of course, not only academics, but we have become sort of, we are ruled, you know, by a chattering class. And the chattering class consists of journalists, television people, one of the great prophetesses, sort of the Salome of the chattering class, has just announced that she's going to quit, as you probably heard, you know. But really, these are our rulers. We don't have emperors and kings and princes anymore, but we have the yak, 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 the yak, 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 the yak, yak, yak. And, you know, Jung warns again this, you don't acquire any real knowledge by way of that. You acquire distraction. It is possible that Jung uses this to also discourage literalism, such as biblical literalism in religion, because certainly the essence of fundamentalism is that bibliolatry, that worship of the word. Never mind the meaning, but just let's worship the words. Because that leads to difficulty. But the culmination is to come in the next chapter, which is again devoted to the anchorite. So you see that, you can see that the anchorite is a big, big theme here. It's very, very important. He won't let go of it. This is now Dies Secundus, the second David, the anchorite, chapter 5. As indicated in day 1 with the anchorite already, these chapters are Jung's first attempt to come to terms with the Christian background of his thinking. In order to do this, Jung uses the literary device, sort of fictitious literary device, to make himself out as a naive person, as a kind of relative ignoramus in his conversations with the anchorite, in order to draw the statements from the anchorite. Oh, Father, I don't know this, I don't know that, tell me about it. Still he is beginning to detect that there is a covert and at times not so covert element of ancient pharaonic spirituality in this place, and perhaps even in the thinking of the anchorite. When the sun rises over the desert, Jung himself sort of turns into an Egyptian mode, and he prays in a quite Egyptian fashion as follows. This is to the sun. Give us your light. You are flame-curled, entwined, crucified, and revived. Give us your light, your light. And this he does in part at the instigation of the anchorite, who, when he went off to sleep in his own little hut, told Jung, now don't forget to say your prayers, your morning prayer. So that this is his morning prayer. He wonders whether Ammonius didn't secretly worship the sun. That's exactly how he puts it. He tries to recollect some of the sentences which the anchorite Ammonius uttered yesterday when they were together. Jung thinks, but this does not sound properly Christian. And then he utters a portentous question referring to Ammonius the anchorite. Is he perhaps a Gnostic? And then he kind of plays around and like the church father, he says, oh, well, that couldn't be, because the anchorite said so many things against becoming attached to words, and the Gnostic certainly used a lot of words. But still, is he perhaps a Gnostic? This is the first time that that term and that concept really appears by name in the Red Book. Yet, this is a momentous recognition on Jung's part. He has tried to reconnect himself with the Christian tradition, went back to the 3rd century, found an anchorite who is apparently Christian, But he comes to the conclusion that the anchorite may be a Gnostic. Jung is increasingly affected now by his surroundings. He is in a desert, but now it is, the emphasis is not on the barrenness and dryness as in his relationship with the desert earlier in the book. You know, when he went to meet his soul, and so the desert really meant a wasteland experience, like has been stated. Here the desert now turns more and more magical and mystical, and in it there are divine things. He prayed to the sun, whom incidentally he called by the Greek name Helios. So he didn't use Pharaonic Egyptian names, but used Helios. But owing to the fact that he has come back into the Hellenistic era, an awful lot of people, most people spoke Greek by then. I also mentioned again, you must forgive me for my being hung up on words here, that Helios, because the H is not pronounced, you know, is very similar to Elias, the Greek word for Elijah. And hasn't he just undergone a great experience earlier with Elijah? Now he sees a scarab, actual live little scarab. We saw some of his depiction. He sees the scarab, and he prays to the scarab as follows. Dear scarab, my father, I know you. Blessed be your work in eternity. Amen. Then he is enamored of the stones that he sees that are present around there, and he addresses them as follows. O mother stone, I love you. I lie snuggled up against your warm body, your late child. Blessed be you, ancient mother. Yours is my heart and all glory and power. Amen. He then seeks out the anchorite. He doesn't wait for him to come and see him, but he goes to the anchorite's hut, and at his request, he reports to him about his prayers and his experiences. He expects the Christian anchorite to condemn him for his pagan prayers. But the anchorite does no such thing. He says, "Be astonished at nothing, and in no case condemn or regret it." The anchorite Ammonius then continues to tell Jung how an old freed slave of his father's has brought him news of Christ and of Christianity. And there is quite a dialogue now recounted between Ammonius and this Christian man, the freed slave. And it's quite an interesting dialogue, but I don't think it's that pertinent to our purposes. But let's say that always the Christian makes certain statements. See, there was this Messiah who came, and then he was killed, he was crucified by the evil people. And then Ammonius, who at that time is still a pagan, cuts in, says, "Oh well, that's just the way Seth killed Osiris." And the Christian says, "Yes, it's like that, but not exactly." And then he goes, he always refers back to the ancient religion, and the man says, it is like that, but it's also different. And at the conclusion of that dialogue, which Ammonius recounts, the dialogue between Ammonius and that Christian man, Ammonius comes to an important insight. He recounts, "But like an echo from distant rock faces, the words return to me. A man and yet the Son of God." That's what he was told about Christ. "And this phrase was what brought me to Christianity." That to him was the clinching statement. Now, obviously you have a similarity here with Jung's orientation, to which he has already given some voice in the earlier chapters, that the divine at some point comes to reside in the human. and that the great desired objective in various ways is the conjunction of the human and the divine. So Ammonius says, that's what these people are teaching, that there was someone, God and man, at the same time. And that is what really illumines him. It is this phrase that brought me to Christianity, says the anchorite. Then follows a significant exchange. Jung also asks Ammonius, but don't you think that Christianity could ultimately be a transformation of your Egyptian teachings? I could. That's exactly just like that. So, you know, it could be one of these numerous scholars who have tried to do that, one of them having been my late teacher, Alvin Boyd Kuhn, and others. So I've been always favorable to Egyptian hypotheses. So don't you think that Christianity could ultimately be a transformation of your Egyptian teachings? Ammonius answers, if you say that our old teachings were less adequate expressions of Christianity, then I am more likely to agree with you. So the anchorite recognizes a connection, but he sees a development, even as Tertullian and Augustine said that the true religion was always in the world, but when Jesus came, then it came to be called Christianity. How many of your radio and television preachers would admit that, you know? Of course not. In any event, this is very, very significant. Then, responding to further questioning on Jung's part, the anchorite says, it's erroneous to believe that religions differ in their innermost essence. Strictly speaking, it's always one and the same religion. Every subsequent form of religion is the meaning of the antecedent. Now, this is about as far from, you know, there are little indications of it, as I just mentioned, but it's really far from Christian orthodoxy. This is, let's say, a manifestation of what I like to call the higher ecumenicity. There is the lower ecumenicity, which tries to reduce every religion to its lowest common denominator. Oh, they all say the same thing. They all say that you should be good and not bad, and, you know, reducing it to ethics and things like that. But here the indication is, in essence, at the core, there is an identity, because it is the same great endeavor of the human and the divine to come together that motivates religions. So that's a very, very important statement, and at that particular time, this was probably written about 1913, 1914, that's a big statement. So they don't differ in their innermost essence. Every subsequent form of religion is the meaning of the antecedent. Jung eventually annoys and scares the anchorite with his questions. He just keeps bugging him, you know. And then he finds himself transported back into the 20th century. Because the anchorite just says, you are tempting me, or you are just like a devil. And when he says that, Jung finds himself back in the present. So that's how time travel goes on. You annoy an anchorite, and then you come back. Very, very simple, very simple. You just have to know how to do it, you know. And he comes back to the 20th century, and Ammonius also says prior to that he is studying the scriptures in order to find their hidden meaning. And he says, the hidden meaning which points to the future. Now, I don't think that this has to do with ordinary prophecy, so we are going to find in the hidden part of the sacred scriptures as to whether the world is going to end in 2012 or some other balderdash like that. But rather, that some of the hidden meaning will become meaningful and important and transformative in a future time. And that, I think, is a much more creative way of looking at this situation. He then hears a poetic passage relating to Christ, to what I would say as a Gnostic savior, and who writes it down. I know that you would like to hear the tidings of he whom things have not lived, but who lived and fulfilled himself. Note that. Somebody who was not lived by something else, but who lived and fulfilled himself. It's the ultimate spiritual authenticity. For you are a son of the earth, sucked dry by the suckling earth that can suck nothing out of itself, but rather suckles only from the sun. Therefore you would like to have tidings of the sun, this is S-O-N, of the sun of the sun, S-O-N of S-U-M, which shines and does not suckle. You would like to hear of the Son of God, who shone and gave, who begot, and to whom life was born again, as the earth bears the sun, green and colorful children. You would like to hear of him, the radiating Savior, who as a son of the sun cut through the webs of the earth, who sundered the magic threads and released those in bondage, who owned himself and was no one's servant, who sucked no one dry, he was not a vampire, and whose treasure no one exhausted. You would like to hear of him who was not darkened by the shadow of earth, but illuminated it, who saw the thoughts of all, and whose thoughts no one guessed, who possessed in himself the meaning of all things, and whose meaning no thing could express. There are some similarities here, even identical sentences with some of the Gnostic scriptures. So it's a very remarkable statement indeed. So what we have here, the emphasis on the God-man, the Egyptian connection, the Egyptian roots of at least Gnostic Christianity and probably of Christianity itself, and then the universality of religious truths. These are the ones that were expressed here in these two chapters of the Anchorite, although there is more to come later. Now, again, you'll indulge me just for a few minutes. There is one more chapter, which is the sixth chapter, and this again is one that is sort of inserted here between the two chapters that deal with the second and the third chapter that deals with the Anchorite, and this relates to death. Now, he has come back to the 20th century, he is out of the desert for the time being, and he finds himself in a terrain very different from those wherein we have encountered him before. It is neither the barren, the depressive kind of desert, where he met, say, and discussed with his soul, nor the lively and deified desert where he met the Anchorite. It is not the forest where hidden castles and temples stand. He finds himself in a cold, foreboding, and dark country which he calls a northern land. Now, we need to keep in mind that in many mythologies, the north was often regarded as the land of death. And that is, I think, largely because the sun is weak and seems to die as further north you go. And the sun is the source of life, the source of light. So here he is, everywhere is dark, cold water that moves at various speeds toward the vast and fathomless dark ocean. On a hill overlooking the dreary scene stands a figure, clad in a dark, wrinkled coat. He reveals himself as either a personification of death or a messenger of death. Together, Jung and this dark figure observe, then this requires the talent of a Doré or a William Blake to depict incredible image of a vast, densely pressed multitude of people, even animals, floating by, accompanied by many dead flowers, remnants of a dead and past summer, as he puts it. They are sort of half floating, half flying down these waterways toward the ocean. and they reach the ocean, and then he sees them dissolve as they reach the sea. And then he sees a ball composed of fire and blood into which the dead had dissolved rise from the ocean. So there is some kind of transformation going on of the dead, but he doesn't quite know what. Jung then thinks a great deal on the meaning and the nature of death. He indicates that life and death must strike a balance, that at certain times people seem to desire death, and as he writes, no doubt referring to World War I, which, since this was written in 1914, is right taking place, today's men need a large slice of death. Well, they sure got it. There is a little indication here also of the two great world spirits that the Greeks spoke about. Sigmund Freud, in the final stages of his instinct theory, acknowledged them, Eros and Thanatos, the life instinct and the death instinct. And that people, there are times when people actually collectively rush toward death. They welcome death, and that this definitely was the case in the early phases of World War I. That also occurred at other times. I'm reminded of the one of the strange war cries that was common in the Spanish Civil War, Viva la Muerta, long live death. So, interestingly enough, what Jung then states, that there is something unacceptable, awfully repulsive, and that is not death. You know what it is? Birth. Oh, you should hear the nasty things that he says about birth. They delighted me so much that I had to get up from the table and jump around, because I have felt similarly about it. Or maybe the necessity to be born again. He says, here I'm dying, and then I have to be born again. In a typical Gnostic fashion, the entire cycle of birth and death repulses and disgusts him. He resists and deplores this process, and then he writes, for 3 nights I was assaulted by the horrors of birth. On the 3rd night, jungle-like laughter pealed forth. That probably like birds who are sort of ha 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 ha, in the jungle. So jungle-like laughter pealed forth. Then life began to stir again. This is preceded by an ending to his first vision of death. He says, when I comprehended my darkness, when I fully comprehended my darkness, one might say, a truly magnificent night came over me, and my dream plunged me into the depths of the millennia, and from it my phoenix ascended. So what we have here is the overcoming of death, which he only mentions in part, and then the overcoming of birth, because he does not speak here of the dead rising from the grave or something, but he speaks of a phoenix. So where does the phoenix come from? From the ashes. So when the previous form, with all of its birth and death and this whole biological situation, is gone, it is burned to ashes, then from those ashes rises the phoenix. That what needs to happen is a spiritual process, a spiritual awakening, which will put an end to the tedious and painful cycle of death and life. I didn't read these portions for you because there is really no call for it, but you know, when he writes about that, he sees himself dying. He says, here I lie in misery on this dung heap. And the dogs come by and urinate on him. Indignity heaped upon indignity and just, misery. And then he says, I wait, what is it, 3 days, and then I have to be born. And he recounts the old saying in Latin, which, you know, I'm born between feces and urine and blood. And he says, says, this is horrible. We die badly and we come into this world badly. And these are really two bad things. I certainly agree with him. And so what has to happen? You have to awaken like the phoenix. And then all of this is, to say the least, it's ameliorated. And you rise to a life that is different. And you have broken out of that particular terrible cycle. But that has to be a spiritual event. It's an event of spiritual awakening. It's an event of spiritual transformation. It's an event of gnosis. And that is what he has already discovered in the desert. And that is what now takes away all that horror from him, because he knows that there is another way. He knows that there is a way out of that dreadful cycle, which incidentally is not just such a, Jung's dark recognition, but look in the innumerable statements of Buddha in the sutras and everywhere else, where the birth and death is represented as a wheel, and we have to get off the wheel. And so he ends the chapter on death with the recognition there is a way of phoenix-like rising from all of this, rising above it, overcoming it, not just overcoming death, but overcoming birth as well. And that, I think, is, especially when its full measure or some of its greater measure is realized, is a great and wonderful promise. And on that promise we'll end our discussions this evening, and we'll gather again hopefully 2 weeks from this evening. Thank you.
Copyright UNGIS by Lisa Recordings. Catalog number 200504. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.